Say a word of welcome and greeting to you. It's a source of particular joy to have you gathered together with us today for a day of study and prayer on the meaning of faithfulness to the church and religious life. Your presence here is a source of great mutual encouragement and support and faithfulness to our Lord Jesus Christ, to His Holy Church, and to our Holy Father, Pope John Paul II. I'd like to tell you a little about a letter I had the other day from a young cousin of mine. She's going to college, and she is not very much on time. She sent me her Christmas greetings. But in her little letter, she said how much she loved and admired Pope John Paul II, and she had known, knows of many of her young friends who have returned to the church through his influence and his example and everything. And she said, "You know, I think if he told us not to eat grapefruit, I wouldn't go near one." So she really has great faithfulness and loyalty to the Holy Father. I want to say a special word of thanks to Mother Imelda and the Daughters of Providence for hosting our meeting and letting us use their wonderful facilities, to my hardworking staff for getting out all of the announcements and taking care of all of the arrangements, and last but not least, to our own Father Hardin, our peripatetic theologian, author, lecturer, etc. Finally, thanks to all of you who came. Before we begin our first station, I just want to take a minute to promote the membership of associates and auxiliaries. We have brochures, membership cards, and religious life on the table in the library there where you can pick them up. We need more membership members, especially among the laity. So if you have any friends or members of your family or anyone whom you could persuade to join our institute through membership, we would urge you to do so. As a matter of fact, we have a program, we are putting a program together to ask all of our affiliated communities to mail out a letter that Father Cardinal Carberry has written to their friends, asking them to become members. we've only, since Mother Claudia and Mother Priscilla are on the executive committee, and they were involved in all this, they were the first ones who volunteered to send this letter out, but when we get it all ready, we will be contacting the other communities to ask them to do that. So the need for more memberships is critical for two reasons. It is, we need the prayer and sacrifice of as many as possible. Our Lord said, "Where two or three are gathered together in my name, there I will be in the midst of him." And I think St. Thomas Aquinas said, if that is true of two or three, if a whole multitude are praying together, then this prayer would be irresistible to the divine majesty of God. So, with that bit of promotion for my own sake here, I will now turn the meeting over to Father Hardin. Our first item is the discussion of problem areas in religious life.
Yeah, thank you, Father. You should have...
They don't
in
all
your hands? Do they have a copy of this?
No. Just the major superior have a copy of that.
Well,
that you can read.
What I can do then maybe is read the seven problem areas we discussed in Alton and again in Boston. And as a start, I thought we might begin with these seven, to which then, of course, you are welcome to add others. Apparently you don't have a list of these, is that it? Well, please. Distribute whatever you have.
Read them one at a time.
Distribute whatever you have. Number one, young people coming into communities do not know basic Christian doctrine. I should add that in both cities, both in Alton and in Boston, these seven were fairly well agreed on and independent one of the other. Young people coming into communities do not know basic Christian doctrine. Second, how combine consultive action with obedience? How combine consultive or consultative action with obedience? To what extent is or should dialogue called for in the new look on obedience? Third, stability in religious vocation, how to support, how to maintain religious vocations that begin with great generosity, and then sadly so many have petered out. Fourth, how to live a simple lifestyle. Fifth, how dependent or independent should religious be? The talk nowadays, as you know, is about being autonomous. To what extent can legitimate autonomy be identified or at least squared with sound religious life? Sixth, the need for good, faithful communities to be publicized. I'd like to say that we are that sound religious communities are the silent majority. I'm afraid they are silent and perhaps by now the minority. How to publicize? And seventh, how cope with polarization or deviations from the church's teaching in religious communities? These are even good communities that have their own share of dissenters, more or less vocal, depending on their aggressiveness and the freedom they have to express themselves. Now, what we did both in Alton and Boston is to ask for suggestions for areas that, in addition to the seven we've just covered, that you think would be worth our discussing. Then what we do is go back and for a few minutes go over each one with contributions from the participants, and I act as a kind of moderator. Any other areas of problem that you think we should or could legitimately raise? Well, may I suggest two other areas? One, the relationship of religious communities to the bishops, on which, as you know, the Holy See has a document that has just recently been published. And the second, which will be the subject of a discussion later on which I have a presentation to make. This is in the light of the latest document of the Holy See on what is called human promotion. To what extent or in what sense are we as religious to be involved in the promotion of the betterment of human society? As you know, there is a built-in dialectic between the apostolate as evangelization and the apostolate as human betterment or human improvement. To what extent can and should religious be involved in improving the human condition, either of society at large or of the people among whom they labor. Both have documents from Rome directed to religious, and I would suggest maybe those two could also be touched on. Now, the procedure we've been following is, and this is strictly a contribution from your side, one thing that I have found, and this is now the third of a meeting with major superiors and others representing them of the affiliates, and I believe the one thing that we most need is to be able to relate to one another at meetings such as this with great frankness, but also with the confidence that God will somehow help us working together in a way that we wouldn't be helped if we worked as individual communities. Now, what I have been doing, and I'll take the liberty of doing it here, is to ask for any contributions and, if necessary, to call on someone to make a contribution. So on the first one, young people coming into communities do not know the basic Christian doctrine. May I ask, Sister Ursula, I begin with my friends, people that I really know.
You want me to make a contribution on this, I take it.
Please?
You want me to give my contribution
yes.
on this topic? I agree with the statement, and in working with our young people in the past 5 years, the girls coming into the postulancy and the affiliates, there is a need to give basic Catholic doctrine to the young people. I also sense a hunger at the same time. It's not a lack, only a lack of knowledge, but a hunger for the truth, for the life of Christ, for what is good in their lives. In fact, tomorrow I'm having a day of insight for young people, and I had one or two young women of the group that registered call me and say, I'm hungry for something in the spiritual life, that's why I'm coming. Perhaps all these young people may not be religious, but we have to give them something basic to live for in their religion and for the Catholic Church. However, in the formation training itself, I can speak from my experience, I think we have to give a basic Christian doctrine program to the young people if we want to build on vows. You cannot build on the vows.
Now, may I ask, Sister, would you say that their need for basic Christian doctrine is such that efforts should be made even before they enter to make certain that they know some basic Christian doctrine before they enter a community?
This would be good if it's possible to meet with the girls at some basic time, some set time. I think it's essential. And if not, if this cannot be done for certain reasons, distance or whatever, then I think a program should be provided in the initial formation. And we are doing this in our community. And what we consider, perhaps all of us, might be something very simple and basic. To the girls, this is something that they have never heard of. For example, Lent is coming up, the fast in Lent, a spirit of discipline, mortification. Some of the girls will tell you this has never been brought up in their own parishes. They knew it was Lent, but that's about it. And they want to do something. They want to discipline themselves in some way in the spirit. In Catholic doctrine itself, prayer, essential prayers, the Apostles' Creed, the mysteries of the Rosary, these are very essential mysteries of our religion that we have to give.
Would you say that there are some prospective candidates for the religious life who would not know the Apostles' Creed? Is that possible? Are there any other? Thank you, Sister. Sister Linda?
Well, I agree very much with what Sister Ursula said. You know, we have them coming in with all kinds of backgrounds. Some may have just been a convert for a couple years, and some of them have even probably perhaps fallen away from the church for a period of time in their life. And they just come in so confused, especially, I think, with the teachings in the church. And as I said, there's a real hunger. I would almost consider it like first graders. I thought first graders, you can teach, you know, first graders the basics of the faith, and they're just hungry for this real life. And I find it the same way with the girls coming in.
There's a great need.
A great need for it and a hunger for it.
Sister.
One of the girls that came to me said, "Sister, I haven't learned how to pray the rosary yet." She was a sophomore in high school. Would you please show me how to pray the rosary?
Well, this first question is so serious that it has cost me 3 years. Is it? It's more than 3 years, isn't it? Since you got me involved?
5 years.
And I would say conservatively, 2,000 hours, at least 2,000 hours of work. I just got from Doubleday, it's coming out in October, the Question and Answer Catholic Catechism. And Sister Linda was the one who put me up to it, because she said, from all that I have been able to see, and that was 5 years ago, that the girls coming into convents these days just don't know even the most elementary doctrines of the faith. So with Sister's assistance, there's been a lot of work put in on this. There are 1,800 questions and answers. And you might, if I just read the first few questions. Why did God make us? First question. Does that sound familiar? God made us to know Him, love Him, and serve Him, and thereby reach heaven. Second question. Why did God make other creatures? God made other creatures to help us reach heaven. And so it goes on through 512 pages, which may have to be somewhat cut down. But all I can tell you is, and in 5 years, it is 5 years, I have been informed, mainly in the East, that the extent of religious illiteracy among the young is unbelievable. And this is, hopefully, to be my contribution to remove some of that illiteracy. Any other questions on that first one?
What's the title of your new catechism?
It's called the Question and Answer Catholic Catechism. That was Doubleday's request. Father.
I came back from the Resurrection Fathers Formation meeting in Canada during the holidays, and they brought that point out that you're bringing out, that Sister brought out, that the knowledge is so minimal in some of the applicants or to the religious life because of what they're reading in Catholic newspapers. They're confused. They read opinions of theologians. They think these are facts. So that many of these young people are confused. They're really genuinely confused. They think they have strange theories about creation of the world and creation of our first parents, and that's why they're becoming sort of religious doctrine midgets. They're very illiterate in their knowledge of the Catholic faith. And they go through CCD programs sometimes, which are a washout. They said they didn't learn much there. And as Sister said, it depends where they have been through getting their religious training. So we have to accept them as they are today.
And now this is, I think, frankly, the whole day could be spent on this first one, because, frankly, in the absence of sound knowledge, even they're joining, say, a religious institute. The question arises, do they know what they're getting into? And it might well be, after having become emotionally involved, as they can well be, with religious life, but in the absence of sound knowledge, and once that emotional appeal wears off, they have nothing to really hold on to sustain them in their religious life. In any case, any others on number one?
Sister. I come from Holy Name Seminary up in Madison, and what Sister was saying there, many of the students that begin there have the same problem. They don't know how to say the rosary. They really don't know how to say it. They've never said it in their mind. And I think that what Sister here was saying was the hunger that young people have today, I think that just a proof of that would be the number of cults that there are all over and the number of people that are taken up in cults, and very often the way they come in contact with the cults is by Bible programs and things like that. You know, they're really attracted to that. They think that by going into that, they're going to find something to satisfy their hunger. And actually, of course, they're not looking at the right place, but that's just, you know, illustrates the need, I think.
Well, may I suggest that some thought be given before the end of the day. It could be even one simple resolution of some kind as to what the Institute can do corporately as a group of religious communities to help at least reduce this religious illiteracy. Because frankly, I think unless that is tackled, everything else is in danger. Sister?
Father, I've taught Catholics in Catholic schools for over 40 years, and now I have CCD, which is every 2 weeks for about an hour and 10 minutes. And when I compare the knowledge of the CCD students to what I had in Catholic schools, it's practically nothing. I could say there's three or four grades difference in there in the knowledge of religion. And then you get them to come 1 week, and then they don't show up. I have some missing 4 or 5 times out of the 13 times we've had it. And so you can see that their religion instruction is practically nothing what they learn one time. In the 2 weeks they come back, they don't know anymore what you taught them the first time. And if there's no reinforcement at home, I can see where many of these children grow up with no knowledge of the basic facts of their faith.
Well, I consider the matter so serious, as I told my students in New York last night, that barring some extraordinary influx of grace, which I'm frankly hoping that God will send, I predict, and I don't think I am being prophetic in saying this, that by the turn of the century, whole dioceses of the United States will be lost to the faith. We already have, historically, some 2,000 extinct dioceses. In fact, auxiliary bishops get the title of an extinct diocese. There are so many. To this day, London is not a Catholic diocese, 400 years after the Reformation. In other words, the situation is much more grave than any of us in our most macabre dreams would suspect. And if we still want religious vocations, and we sure do, they come only from believers, and they better know something about their faith if they're going to make, as we hope, a lifetime commitment. This came up both in Alton and in Boston first. Shall we go on to number two? How combine consultive or consultative action with obedience? In other words, to what extent Is it wise or should those who owe obedience in a community be consulted on what they're supposed to be obedient about? Any questions or comments? Any ideas? Father Geiger, I see you back there. I'm calling on those I feel safe won't be offended.
What comes to my mind immediately, of course, is the example of our own Blessed Maximian Kolbe, who could be called the saint of holy obedience of this century. And he had a marvelous concept of obedience, and I think this is what we have to teach to the young people, how exactly this obedience works and how God does work through us. And his point was that, yes, we look upon the superiors as the ones who express God's will for us. However, that doesn't mean we sit there and wait until the superior says something, but rather God is constantly giving us inspirations and guidance, inner guidance, and these things develop within. And his point was that as these inspirations begin to develop within us, then we begin to discuss them, especially if it deals with something that we feel the Lord is inspiring us to do. That we discuss them first with our spiritual director and then with the relative superior. And he was quite strong in the idea that you give a hearing. The superior should hear you out, and you keep bringing this up until you feel confident that you have got a hearing. But then, once the superior makes the final decision, you accept that as God's will.
Well, would you say, Father, that there has been some development in the spirituality of obedience, say in the last generation or so, legitimate development along these lines? Would you say there has been some?
Yes, I would say.
In what way, Father?
In precisely this idea. I can look back in my own religious life, and we were, as young religious, especially religious brothers, were not consulted really much about anything. And now, of course, the superior doesn't really go ahead without bringing this up and saying, well, what do you feel about it, and so on. And it can go to the opposite extreme, that's true. I don't think we've gone too far to the opposite extreme, but yes, the fact that a realization now that the inspiration of God doesn't only come to superiors, but it also works through all the members of the community, I think this realization is healthy and very valid, but it must not work against the, in ideal cases, it does not work against the idea that the superior still has this mandate from God and still has to make the final decision.
Any other comments, Sister?
In many of our homes today, we have local house assemblies in which the sisters meet together, for example, once a month, in which they openly discuss issues pertaining to the community life. But ultimately, the decision lies with the superior. And I think this is what our sisters have to understand, reflect upon, that the superior is the will of God. And if she can accept the superior as God's will for her, this leads then to the church as the will of God, the Spirit working in the church, the obedience to the bishops, obedience to the Holy Father. But the question that I have is, how can we instill this Spirit in our young people who come into religious life that are so independent? And
for them, in often many cases, they have been totally, you might say, been unexposed to obedience in any intelligible sense, so that I think we're dealing with also a cultural phenomenon. Who exercises authority these days? And as a consequence, I think it's that delicate combination. Notice the word is how combine. the authentic obedience with what for many people has become almost a substitute for obedience.
In answer to Sister Ursula's question, I noticed something very interesting. I just hastily glanced at the paper this morning, the Chicago Tribune, and I noticed an article on the bottom of the page of an FBI informer who was working among the mafia, and he was pointing out the tremendous impact of the film The Godfather upon the young mafiosi, who they were so impressed with this film that they began a kind of a nostalgia trip in which they began picking up some of the old rituals of the mafia, like kissing the hands of the older men in the mafia and so forth. And I thought to myself, this is really very interesting, because it shows among the young people a desire for some kind of structure and the signs and so forth of it. And a way to instill this, it seems to me, to feed them constantly the examples of the saints, and especially the more modern saints in this regard. I don't think they're going to be too impressed with just the theories of obedience, but when you present to them the images of how the saints really act.
This would be a very good thing. Now, actually, Father, of course, Blessed Maximilian is an outstanding example, but even from this century, we have people who have been raised, if not to sainthood, although we've got those too. Mother Cabrini is one. Well, Elizabeth Seton, though her lifespan goes back. And perhaps we have been neglecting modern religious saints. We should not overlook, you might say, the great historic saints of the Church's tradition. But there are those, take Dominic Savio and his relationship to Don Bosco. In other words, to teach by example and have these things available, I'm afraid that many people, whether beatified or canonized, and except for the celebration even in the community itself, after that passes on, people forget that there even were such persons, one of whose main reasons for canonization or beatification is they become our models. Any other comments, Father?
In a humorous vein, I heard this said during the Second Vatican Council that we have no more three religious vows. We only have poverty, chastity, and discussion.
Well, this is what, for some people, my record when I was teaching here in Chicago at the Jesuit School of Theology, I've counted them till I could quote it, my record in 1 week was 25 hours of committee meetings. 1 week, 25 hours. Until you almost forget that somebody is to call the shots.
Is there a departure now from using the word superior to a leader of the religion?
Almost, but I've met... But Father, I've met a new one. I thought I had my vocabulary updated. 2 weeks ago, Father Bradley, who is my immediate superior at the institute where I teach in New York, and Father Nolan, the pastor of Incarnation Parish in Jamaica, they asked me, would I please accompany them to try to convince a community of sisters they should allow other sisters to use their facilities, because we desperately need housing for religious women studying in New York. Well, to make a long story short, the group that is there was not happy with having others come in. But the first one who spoke was identified as the contact. I thought I've heard everything. She's no longer superior. She's not coordinator. She's not facilitator. She is the contact. So I was curious. I says, now what does she contact? Well, it's not she contacting, but others contacting her. You're right, Father. And we better get back to some notion of superior. Number three. Do you see a problem in the stability in Vidya's vocation? And how to support that stability? Brother? Canalis, what would you say?
In the stability of
it? Yes, in other words, how would you think, or what can we do to foster the stability in religious vocations who seem to come to us with great generosity and then something happens?
It seems to me there's another thing going around nowadays in communities, this business of a temporary vocation. This is being advocated far and wide, I think. And I think that the young people have to be taught that a vocation or a call is a call to permanency in religious life. Unless that is instilled into them, they are, you know, they stand to lose many if they think they can come and serve only for a time. Don't you think?
This is very true. If I may just add a comment to what you said, I think theologically the great need is to make a distinction between vocation as coming from God and commitment as coming from man. I think we have, not necessarily we, but I think in religious circles, there has been a lack of clarity as to just what is a vocation. A vocation as such is that special grace that some receive to enter on a lifetime commitment to living the councils. And we should, I think, never let go of the notion of vocation as grace. That's God's side. We don't promote vocations. We discover them. We don't give vocations. We find them. Vocation is a special grace. And in St. Paul's vocabulary, it is a charism. That is the grace which is intended for apostolic purposes, St. Paul's definition of a charism. Or my definition of St. Paul's use of the word charism. Some have it, some don't. Now, where I think the instability comes in is on the side of the commitment. There is no doubt that all too many religious have opted for a temporary commitment. But let's not call that a temporary vocation. It's either a genuine religious vocation and it's for a lifetime, or it's not a religious vocation. Any other sister?
My experience working with the younger women in our community has been that the factor of the stability has drawn them, because they are experiencing so much instability, let's say in society in general or in the marriages of their families or whatever, and they really experience that call to want something permanent that will last, and they are looking for communities that are secure and stable, and I find that a positive factor, that they are seeking a more stabilized way.
They want
something that will last.
Where there is a genuine vocation, you're right, sister, where there's a genuine vocation, I know of no exceptions. The man or woman is always looking for a community where they can remain set for life. It is well to know, by the way, and this is just too obvious for words, that stable and stability come from the same Latin word as state of life, namely stare. There are circles now where even to talk about a state of life is unintelligible, because there are so many people. In marriage, we have reached, as we know, last year, the record of more than 50% the divorce rate in America. European sociologists describe the United States as the most unstable society in human history. So this will affect the stability of religious life. But let's never mistake the word. If a person is unstable, it's because of their lack of stability in committing themselves. Let's never say that the grace of a genuine vocation is not for life. Thanks, brother. This is it. Father?
Some young people coming to religious communities always also bring up the idea that there are temporary commitments of their fellow young friends in the United States of VISTA, Peace Corps, PABLA, Papal Volunteers to Latin America, or some other volunteer programs that the United States sponsored, for example, or the church sponsored. So they have an idea of what it can be for a time, and they can do the same thing in religious life. And further, they say that, furthermore, they see how priests leave their vocation and seek papal dispensation, or some religious men and women do the same thing. So they feel that there is not so much to this idea of a perpetual or lifetime commitment. They are kind of muddled in the idea of a complete dedication. I heard one group of religious men recently tell me that they said that you really don't have a lifetime commitment. You are making your vows for a year. They say, in fact, we'd like to see a pledge, a promise only, to live in religious life for some time. And later on, when they are trying to discern their vocations beyond that 1, 2, or 3, or 6 year period, they're trying to discern whether they really have a vocation. That's different from the time that we were in a religious life and our novitiate. And we were told by the Master of Novices, you come here, you make this vow for a year, the first vows, but it's to God for good. When God permits you, you're going to make the perpetual vows in due time. But now you're committing your soul to God for good.
And Father, to make sure that even with temporary vows, which are part of the church's structure, that we never allow people to think of this as somehow a test of their vocation. It is a test of their commitment. And vocabulary here is awfully important.
And that leaves the young person in a quandary, in a doubt. He says, I'm going to check out on my, I'm discerning whether I do have that vocation after making the novitiate postulancy or the affiliate program, associate program, and then a novitiate. They still have that doubt in their mind, a big question mark. And I think it's an uncertain way to proceed. I know there are people that leave the religious communities. We know that professed members leave and so on. But it's still that we should not start with that idea in a novice, somebody starting in our community, with that doubt that eventually you're going to find out whether you have a community vocation or not.
Now, what I
period of the novitiate, excuse me.
But what I think we have to be realistic in recognizing is that young people coming into communities from an unstable society need a lot of education or re-education. And one thing, I was meeting with Mother Claudia's council the other day in Philadelphia. They're having their chapter coming up this summer. One large contributing factor, I think, to this whole business of instability has been the number of chapters that from one chapter session to the next you have sometimes a complete overhauling of the Institute. What security does a religious have if they don't know what's going to happen maybe in the next chapter? So that whatever else religious communities that want to foster stability in communities, in God's name I tell them, stop your revolutionary chapters. Stop re-examining that which should not have been examined in the first place, but assumed. That's why the late Holy Father, Paul VI, sent the Jesuit delegates home from our last general chapter. They began to re-examine some of the principles of St. Ignatius. He wrote them letters, they wouldn't. They continued re-examining, so he told them, and this is the first time in four centuries, maybe the first time ever, that a pope told the delegates of a general chapter of a large religious order to go home. Because you cannot, on the highest level of the order, be re-examined the non-negotiables of a religious institute and expect your members to be stable to an unstable institute. Sister.
Father, I find, with regard to the stability and instability, the difference between those that are coming in right out of high school and 1 or 2 years out of high school and the older candidate. I think the older candidate that comes in with this whole idea of really commitment and dedication and of experience and stability. But with the younger, I think that as soon as the going gets rougher, they start rubbing edges with others and really starting to experience community life. They just want to throw up give everything up and go home. And it just takes hours and hours of working with them.
I would say, I agree, sister, the one exception to that, I think, is in communities that have the equivalent of an aspirancy, where from, say, high school or even beginning with high school days up to, say, 18 or 20, they are not exposed or immersed in this very unstable culture. And the outstanding example in my experience is the Daughters of St. Paul. Their present provincial for the United States is 36 years old, who entered at the age of 15. And from what I know of her, she is a very stable personality. But of course, it would look like she was brainwashed. But I think we should re-examine that too, because the whole question is, who's going to do the brainwashing? Is it we or the world? There is no person in the world who is not brainwashed. We don't use the term. We are all affected by the people among whom we live. So I think you're right, sister. Taken out of the world, I think those who have weathered the storm and have managed somehow to survive in a very insecure society tend to remain more stable in religious institutes. Can I go on, Father?
Yeah, we better. We're over time now.
So what do we do?
Well, we'll give 5 more minutes. We're 5 minutes over time now. It's up to you. Do you want to finish these points, or
what follows,
take a
Father?
Break?
What follows?
Your talk on the formation.
How long is the break?
15 minutes.
Oh. Can I make a decision, or at least can I consult and suggest a...
We'll give you five more minutes of this, and then we'll take a break and decide what to do.
Okay. Number 4, how to live a simple lifestyle. Any comments on that? I suppose it's what is meant by simple lifestyle, sister.
I think we have to start at the very beginning. When the candidates enter the community, in some way there must be decision made as to what they can bring into the community, how much they can bring into the community. Girls coming out of college or from college sometimes could make the comparison of religious life to a college dormitory. And this is what we don't need and we don't want. And so we have to start at the very beginning, before they enter, giving them a list of what they can bring.
Now, would you, this is probably more than you do, in this list or in a parallel list, would you also indicate what they are not to bring?
We don't, but it would be maybe a good idea if we did.
What do you think? Because if the girl, say, brings certain things that she wants to then put to use, she brings her hi-fi.
The thought crossed my mind, Father. Right? And as a candidate, I live in community for maybe a month or so. In my mind, I think of the story in Scripture where the man is, where the Lord says, if you put your hand to the plow, do not look back. Because in conversation, they'll say, oh, I have this at home. I think I'll tell my mother to bring it to me. And they look at me, could I? And I say, it wasn't on the list. And they'll,
Well, I would say by exclusion, it might be, but the list could be so exhaustive that you provide for every reasonable contingency, but be sure to exclude from that list things which you know full well they would want to bring, and maybe even the quantity, the number of certain things, don't you think? Or even the quality, how expensive some of the things are.
And at the same time, we have to instill the spirit of community living, the sharing community spirit must be brought in. And I think this would contribute to the simplicity and lifestyle.
Sister, I think you have a...
I was going to disagree a little bit. I don't particularly like the idea of negating what they may not bring. I think as you're working with the young woman before she enters, you dialogue and you talk about those things, and hopefully she's had enough contact with the community to see that simplicity of lifestyle that is there, that she has seen what your bedroom looks like, to see what we have in common, what we may have, that she learns to make that judgment herself.
You would prevail on the person to make a voluntary decision to...
I'd rather have it come that she sees this. There is going to be a change. These things will be different. This does not fit in with my new lifestyle and new choice, and to help her work through that rather than saying, you can't have that, and I'm going to take that away, and you can't have that. I think if it comes...
Well, don't you think, too, that the lifestyle of the community will determine how much, for example, musical instruments?
She would see that as she has contact with me.
Any other... Right? Number 5. How dependent or independent should religious be? It somewhat affects number 4. Any comments on that? First of all, there's no doubt that some people have a greater autonomy than others. There are more independent characters. I think it is of some moment for a community to think through what kind of people they want. And maybe in the preliminary testing or interviewing, decide that some type of personality, though it might be suitable for another community, would not be for this community. Now, I know for the Society of Jesus, there is a maximum of independence that is tolerated, even to such extremes as Dan Berrigan and so on, which I do not defend. But I think, too, that dependence or independence will depend at least in some measure on the degree to which the community engages in what I would call the corporate apostolate. The more a community is committed to work that is done corporately, the less room, even logically and reasonably, there would be for the kind of independence that could then create difficulties in that institute. Number six, the need for good, faithful communities to be publicized. Any comments? I would almost say it's a desperate need. And much needs to be done. One of the purposes of the Institute is to foster this kind of legitimate publicity. It is living out our Lord's mandate not to allow what we do to be placed under whatever translation you use, a bushel basket, but let the world see what we're doing. And this is where, as you probably know, we've got our Catholic Voice of America started, very much in existence. Quite a few major superiors have written back indicating their interest, and we plan by September to start having religious communities appear on national television in religious habit, describing religious life in general or their own institute in particular. Those that are not living sound religious life are getting too much publicity. The others are not getting enough. And if I can take a minute, how cope with polarization or deviations from the church's teaching in religious communities? Any comments? First, to admit it, to recognize it, and recognize it the larger the community and the community itself. And this, I think, here within a community, is mainly the duty of the superior. Weak superiors, allowing this deviation to continue unchecked, are contributing to the destruction of their institute. One person, especially of influence or prominence in the community, who is permitted to dissent from the recognized church's teaching for religious life, will in time draw others, and in further time we'll draw the community into such convulsion as by now has caused the secularization of most religious communities in the United States. It is not my judgment, it's the judgment of the Holy See. Most American religious communities are either already secularized or are fast secularizing. Sister.
Father, I think that many times if the meetings that these sisters are sent to, you know, if the superior does not screen this, you know, they get material, and of course they infect the community with the things that they've heard.
That must be watched to make sure that some of the wild literature that is available not be easily or at least not readily distributed among religious in the community. I would also say that everyone in a community ought to know what the church's teaching is. The best protection against deviation is to know what the church's teaching is. It is surely time. Right, yeah. Father Donnie?
Yeah. I'm going to take 1 second here to go back to point number six and mention to the superiors or or their representatives here, the Institute office is sending out a news release on all of our meetings. Sometimes we'll get out two. We will on Chicago. We sent one out before the meeting. We'll send one out tonight or tomorrow morning about the meeting. Now, we are sending those to every affiliated community. You get one in the mail. Now, oftentimes, you can get that in your local newspaper. A lot of these little, not the Catholic newspapers, half your more than half. I won't, and don't quote me on that, but you might have trouble getting it in your diocesan paper. But just your local town paper, they're looking for news. You might have to redesign the first paragraph or something to let them know you were there and which members of your community attended, because we don't name all the names in our news releases, see. We always name the communities. But what I wanted to say was, if you could get those news items we sent out, even in your little local town papers, it would be a help. That is publicizing your community as well as the other good communities. And there we go back to the problem of vocation. Young people looking for good communities are going to see that, see? It's a way of letting them know that there are good faithful religious out there. Okay, we'll take a 10-minute break. Be back at 10:45.
Let's make a symbolic sign of the cross in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. My understanding of the schedule is if we go to 11:30 and Mass is at 11:30. And at what would have been or should have been 10:30, provisions of revised code of canon law affecting religious life, what I thought I would do is take just this one document and analyze it for you, because it will be incorporated in canon law. Is that fair? So we have one very definite and specific thing, which we know is the mind of the Church, and you should by now either have or will be getting, you know about the two documents that have come out from the Holy See. The first on religious and human promotion, and the second are the contemplative dimension of religious life. I am analyzing the first of these two documents, which Father Heiser assures us, Father Downing in talking to him in Rome, that the document on formation is not this. Correct, Father? The official document on formation is in the hands of the Holy Father, and I understand from previous conversation with Father Heiser, the Pope wants to make very sure that what it expresses is his mind. He's been holding up the document for months. At any rate, our presentation then now until 11:30 will be, you all have an outline? The title is a strange one. The document itself reads Religious and Human Promotion. The title is ambiguous. The word religious does not modify promotion. This means religious men and women and human promotion. Or religious life and the promotion of human values would be a more accurate title. In the nature of things, all I'll be able to do in 35 minutes is just a few comments beyond what you've got here. I want to say I did this in chapel this morning and ask the Lord to enlighten me. I'd read the document several times, and said, Lord, let me finish this and put it all on one page. It's all on one page. What's the occasion for the church's directives on this subject? There are four principal reasons. First, that there is more oppression of human beings in modern society than ever before in man's history. Where the word oppression in the church's vocabulary means injustice of man to man. Second, all the faithful are in duty bound to assist those who are in grave need. Millions are in grave need. You name the need, and much, some would say most of the human race, goes to bed hungry every night, to mention just one kind of need. Third, if religious are, as they are, part of the church's faithful, they share in that responsibility. But their responsibility is special in two ways, both because they have a special vocation, they are the objects of extraordinary grace from God, and their duty is especially to witness. In other words, they have the duty to witness to the gospel so that whatever else they do,